From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Greece is the first society in history that doesn't give the knee-jerk response, we've always done things this way, that's the reason we're going to do them this way again. They were immensely playful intellectually, and therefore they are so interesting still.
Thomas Cahill says we still have plenty to learn from the ancient Greeks, and not just because Greece was the birthplace of democracy or of the Olympics. Today, we'll explore the enduring legacy of the Greeks and talk about Greek food, Greek gods, and the archaeology of Troy. We'll also visit the fabled island of Crete and get an insider's look at modern Athens.
Life there feels like a great competition, as if people are just vying for space, for jobs, for air. And this creates, I think, a tightness to life.
Best-selling writer Thomas Cahill is writing a series of books on what he calls the hinges of history. They're about ancient cultures that shaped our modern world. His latest is called Sailing the Wine-Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. What's remarkable about the ancient Greeks is the way they revolutionized so many different aspects of life. Art, science, philosophy, and politics. Steve Paulson sat down with Cahill to talk about the glory of ancient Greece.
How do you explain this incredible cultural flowering in this particular place at this time?
Well, very early in the book, I quote the eminent Dr. Seuss and say that it just happened to happen. But it still is true that the geography of Greece certainly was a factor. Greece is so cut up geographically. You know, there's a peninsula here, a peninsula there, islands all over the place. And I think that this meant that there were many, many small communities within Greece.
And I suppose they're always interacting with each other.
Well, that's the other thing.
Sailing from one island to the next.
Yes, the sailing, of course, was a big part of it. And they spoke one language. They all spoke Greek. They knew they were Greeks. And at the same time, the localities and the differences from one locality to another contributed greatly to the variety of Greek culture. For instance, Corinth was a real crossroads between Europe and Asia. It was a place of enormous variety of goods coming in from different places, all sorts of exotica. And Corinth, because of its position, became extremely rich and was known as Fat Corinth to the Greeks themselves. It was a place of absolute and utter sybaritic pleasure. That's what they did in Corinth. Sparta was extremely Spartan. No one had any pleasure in Sparta as far as I can see.
But they seemed to be very good at conducting wars there.
Yeah, they became better and better, but it was landlocked. It didn't have any. It was completely unlike Corinth in that it had no access to anything. And it was the most wretched kind of military dictatorship. I compare it to North Korea. Then you have Athens, the home of democracy and art and free speech, a kind of air of freedom that went through the place, and the home of drama, both of tragedy and comedy. These are very, very different places from one another.
So how do you, Athens, I mean, how do you explain all of the stuff that happened in this particular city?
Well, they got a great kick out of being different from one another. It's certainly true that long before the rise of democracy in Athens, you see it in the Iliad, which is the beginning of Greek literature. On the night before the battle, all the soldiers have arguments about how the battle should be conducted on the next day. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody throws his 2 cents in, and nobody gets hanged from the nearest tree for disagreeing with the general.
And I suppose that must have been a radical development in that day and age.
It stands alone because it's the only society in which the king doesn't have the first and the last word. Everybody else seems to jump in.
You mentioned the Iliad, the first great book certainly in Greek culture, maybe in Western culture. In a lot of ways, the Iliad shows a totally different world than we live in today. I mean, there's all of this talk about honor and glory.
Mm-hmm.
Values that I have a hard time relating to.
No, that's quite true. And I mean, there are two great streams of the Western tradition, the Judeo-Christian and the Greco-Roman. The Judeo-Christian stream gives us our value system, and honor and glory are not at the center of that system. You know, things like justice and charity are, which are very different, and which were not at the center of the Greek system. No two ways about it.
Well, I have to tell you, the Iliad was a story that I always loved as a kid, I mean, in some pared-down version, and I always identified with the Trojans. Hector was the guy I liked, the great tragic hero of the Trojans, and of course he's killed by Achilles, and Achilles to me was this rather unappealing figure, and I don't know if I'm unusual here or if we're meant to identify with the Trojans, with the losers of the war.
Well, first of all, the Iliad is a real boy's story. it's a perfect story for pre-adolescent boys, I think. And in many ways, the Greeks of that period, you could compare them to pre-adolescent boys. That's what they were like, you know. They had lots of fantasies about winning on battlefields, probably a lot more fantasies than actualities. And I also think it's true that for Homer, the secret heroes of the Iliad are not the Greeks, but the Trojans. I agree. And in fact, Iliad is a story about Ilium, which was the ancient name of Troy. So it's not a story about the Greeks. It's a story about Troy. There was an actual Troy, but the Troy that Homer presents is a place that never existed. It's a Shangri-La. It's a place of perfection and peace and wonderful, noble figures like Priam. Priam, the king of the Trojans, is a much more noble and attractive figure than Agamemnon, the king of the Greeks, who's really kind of an extremely annoying guy who's so full of himself that mm-hmm. he can't see what's going on.
And then you get Hector, who is not only a great warrior, but also he's a good family man. I mean, he dotes on his child and his wife, and he's just sort of a good guy all around, and he also knows he's going to die.
The portrayal of Hector and his family is the first time in ancient literature anywhere where a family is shown as a loving unit. Never before that. So I think there are things going on, even in the Iliad, sort of hints in Homer that he doesn't really think that warfare is quite as splendid as everyone else thinks it is. But they're only hints. Then in the later epic, the Odyssey, which I believe Homer wrote when he was old and much more reflective, all those hints in the Iliad come to the fore. And the second epic is really not a hymn to war. It's a hymn to peace.
Well, and it's a much more modern book from our own perspective. I mean, Odysseus he's kind of the anti-hero. I mean, I suppose he's a reasonably skilled fighter, but, you know, he's cunning more than anything
else. That's right. He's the guy who lives by his wits.
Yeah, he's a trickster.
Yeah, and that's what he's really good at. He is not so much a warrior as an extremely canny human being who figures out how to outwit enemies, not by superior strength, but by superior brains.
And then the other thing about Odysseus is that it takes him 10 years from the end of the Trojan War to get home. He's always trying to get home. But you get the sense that he's kind of enjoying himself while he's getting home. And there are lots of beautiful women and adventures and all kinds of
this is Greece.
Interesting things.
And again, this is not the Judeo-Christian epic. This is a Greek epic. And there's no two ways about it that he does enjoy himself along the way. And as far as a Greek would be concerned, there's no reason why he shouldn't. What else would he do?
Now, we've been talking about how so much of our own culture today comes from ancient Greece. There was a dark side to this. I mean, to Athens, this jewel of culture back then, much of the population of Athens was made up of slaves. Women had no political rights at all.
Yeah, if I had been an ancient Greek, I would definitely want to have been one of those free Athenians. You know, to be a woman would really not have been a lot of fun, and certainly not to be a slave. And surely the better part of Athenian society was made up of non-citizens. So when you look back in that way, you know, you see a rather dreary place. But it's still true that these are the first people to think of any form of democracy. And their form of democracy was like California gone mad. Everybody voted on everything all the time. They had a direct democracy. There were no representatives. The assembly of the Greeks was everybody, you know. They all barged into this place on a hill outside Athens, and they all got to vote on it. They even voted on who their generals would be. They communally decided who should be expelled from their city because the person might be gaining too much power and was therefore a threat to the democracy.
How many people would be voting on these matters?
Well, we know that Athens at its height was probably not more than about 250,000 people, and that would have been everybody. And it would have been between 10 and 15% at the outside, 20% who were able to vote.
But that's extraordinary to think that that many people still would be voting on these rather important matters.
I don't think they ever got more than 50% of the eligible citizens into the assembly at any one time. There was another forum that actually got more people, which was the drama, which was an Athenian invention. And it was a political invention, which people don't always realize. It was another way of talking about their politics besides the assembly.
And you have some extraordinary plays. I mean, for instance, the Aristophanes play Lysistrata. I mean, we were talking earlier about war and how warlike the Greeks were in many respects. I mean, this is a play about how the women refuse to have sex with their men as long as they're fighting.
Yeah, it's still hilarious, I think. The stage business is wonderful. I'm not even sure you can say some of it over the air, but
I mean, the thing is, it still is kind of radical today.
Yeah, yeah. And whereas the tragedians set their stories in among the myths of the Greeks and showed in a pointed way how they had something to do with the present, the comic playwrights talked directly about the present and even put on stage the leading figures of Athens and ridiculed them to death. I mean, they made such fun of those people. There are still many places on our contemporary earth where if you did something like that, you'd be tortured or executed. The Athenians loved it. I mean, they took it all in. It was terrific as far as they were concerned. Well, you know, there's a direct relationship between that and Saturday Night Live. I mean, you couldn't have the kind of political comedy that we have if somebody hadn't started it somewhere along the line, and they were the guys who started it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Thomas Cahill, talking with Steve Paulson. Cahill's book is called Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. Food writer Francine Segan has a special fondness for the sumptuous foods of ancient Greece.
To get a feel for everyday life in ancient Greece, read Homer's epics. Homer describes many feasts, and you can really easily imagine sitting there with the men around a table that's filled with finger foods, dips, meat, fish, and a servant coming by, filling your bowl with more wine. Minstrels are playing in the background. Homer talked a lot about dining and social customs, especially the importance of hospitality. Homer said that you had to offer food and drink to anyone who showed up at your door, even before you asked them why they were there. For example, in the Odyssey, after Odysseus's 20-year trek brought him back home, he first went to the hut of a poor swineherder and wasn't even asked about his travels or why he was there until he had his fill of food. A typical dish from Homer's time would be a chickpea dip, served with grilled pita or veggies, and there's a recipe for it in my cookbook, Philosopher's Kitchen. In antiquity, chickpeas and other beans were offered only to good friends. Salt and bean friends was the expression. And the chickpea dip in Philosopher's Kitchen is a delicious puree. Boil the chickpeas with onions, spices, herbs, and puree it up, and then serve it with lemon and mint. It was important to the ancient Greeks to serve mint, as mint was a sign of hospitality. Homer had a lot to say about wine. I especially like what he wrote in the Odyssey. Wine sets even a wise man to singing and to laughing, and gently rouses him to dance, and may even bring forth words that are better left unspoken. It was funny back then. Wine was essential in their minds. In fact, they even had a derogatory expression. A meal without wine was called a dog's dinner.
Didn't quite catch that recipe for chickpea dip? You can see it and a few other recipes by Francine Segan on our website at www.ttbook.org. Did Homer's Trojan War really happen? We'll examine the archaeological record next I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The Iliad is the most famous story about war ever written, but no one knows if the Trojan War ever really happened. The University of Wisconsin's William Aylward is one of the archaeologists who is excavating the ancient site of Troy in what is now northwestern Turkey. He says there is no evidence that a great Greek army ever attacked the city, but tantalizing clues suggest some kind of battle. Aylward's just returned from his latest dig. He stopped by our studio to talk about the mysteries that still surround the Trojan War.
There isn't an historical record per se because we're in prehistory. In the late Bronze Age, and the Bronze Age spanning time from about 3000 to 1000 BC, and the period of the alleged sack of Troy being about 1200 BC, we're still in prehistory. The historical period, as we understand it from Greek civilization, does not begin until much later with the advent of writing, the Greek alphabet, about 800 BC and following. So in the period of the Trojan War, if it ever happened, we're really in the dark. People weren't writing history as we understand it today.
So this is a story that people told? But when you hear this, and you've done quite a lot of research on the site that we believe to be Troy, what do you see that confirms or denies it?
The most impressive site at the archaeological site of Troy are the magnificent fortification walls. A city would not have built such magnificent fortification walls had it not expected to be attacked. So this is one of our most important bits of circumstantial evidence. The stone walls are made of solid stone, solid limestone. They're about 4 meters thick and over 9 meters high, with multiple gates and circuitous paths through the gates to inhibit attackers. Surrounding the stone fortifications on the citadel, which covered an area of about 20,000 square meters at the time of the Troy VI period citadel.
And Troy VI is what we assume was the Troy of the Iliad?
Yes, and then moving into the Troy VII period also. So Troy VI coming to an end about 1275 BC, and then the Troy VIIa period ending about 1175 BC, and this probably being the layer that holds the clues to the attack.
When you talk about Troy VI and Troy VII, yes, what you're really saying, yes, is that there are at least seven different cities of Troy all built in the same place?
Sure. The archaeological site of Troy is like a large layer cake. There are over 10 cities spanning the time from the early Bronze Age, about 3000 BC, to late Byzantine times, about 1400 AD to 1500 AD. That's the final city that we have uncovered at the site. So there are 10 cities, all built one on top of the other, over about 4,500 years.
And it is the sixth, perhaps the seventh, that we're talking about when we read Homer?
The seventh, yes. Okay. The fortification walls that surrounded that city were built in the Troy VI period. There was a massive earthquake that struck the city in about 1275. This brought Troy VI to an end. Then the Troy VII period begins. There's a period of rebuilding, but the city is vulnerable. There are holes in the walls. The walls are patched, new sections of the walls are built, but it seems like they don't get it all together in time, and the city is attacked about 100 years later in 1175, and this might be what we have preserved in Homer's Iliad.
Now, there is no writing that has been found.
There's one small single piece of writing from the very late Bronze Age, but this little piece of writing that we do have is not informative for what's going on at Troy.
Is this unusual? Would you find from the same period writing in most archaeological sites?
We should have more writing at Troy. The Hittite Empire off to the east in central Anatolia from the same period, 13th century BC, has an archive with cuneiform tablets, writing inscribed on clay tablets. off to the west in Greece, in the Peloponnesus, and to some degree on the mainland, there are archives of clay tablets with writing, in that case, Linear B, the writing of the Mycenaean civilization. So we have Troy between these large imperial powers to east and west, both of which are using writing, but we haven't discovered writing to that degree at Troy. And the discovery of writing at Troy, if it's found, it will transform our understanding of what Bronze Age Troy was like.
Are you surprised that there is none there?
Well, we can't say that there isn't any there. It just hasn't been found. So it is surprising that it hasn't been found to date, because excavations have been going on at Troy for, well, off and on for over 130 years. And one would think that with the excavations of Schliemann, Dirtfeld, Carl Blagan from the University of Cincinnati, and now the team directed by Manfred Korfmann of the University of Tübingen, and with Brian Rose from the University of Cincinnati in charge of Greek and Roman excavations, that one would have discovered writing by now.
Schliemann is the one who is generally given credit for discovering the site of Troy, isn't he?
In most accounts, yes. It was actually Frank Calvert who began digging on the site in the 1860s. But Schliemann took over with excavations off and on between 1870 and 1890 and is really most well known in popular circles as the discoverer of Troy. Quite a lot of the work that's going on today at the archaeological site is the removal of the debris that Schliemann dumped on the northern side of the mound. So we have a chance to go through what Schliemann was digging a second time.
When you talk about Troy 6 and 7, this city that had a citadel and substantial walls around it, can you get a sense of what kind of a city it was to live in?
Well, it was certainly stratified in terms of class, let's say. There was a citadel surrounded by these massive stone fortification walls with a palace on the top. And this was certainly inhabited by the elite, the Trojan elite. Below this, on the plateau to the south, extending about 450 meters away from the citadel, there was a lesser fortified lower city inhabited by the common people of Troy. And beyond that, there would have been farms, orchards, and fields, cultivated fields, from which the citadel of Troy would have derived its food supply and wealth. Troy was also involved, probably, in control over maritime traffic in the Dardanelles. It had a strategic location right on the Dardanelles, being the only maritime passage between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. So all maritime traffic moving between these areas would have had to have passed right by Troy. So we can certainly understand that Troy would have been involved in some sort of taxation or control over the movement of commodities through that waterway.
How many people do you suppose lived there?
The estimates now published suppose about 7,000 people were living in the city of Troy 6, let's say Priam's citadel.
So its importance came not from its size, but from its location?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct.
Is it ever possible for you or any of your fellow scientists to dig at Troy without the Iliad in the back of your mind?
It's impossible. The story is too much ingrained in what we do as classicists, what we do as archaeologists, working in what is now northwestern Turkey. The Iliad and the story of the Trojan War has great resonance in the entire region. So one cannot go to the area and pretend that they don't have the Iliad in the back of their minds.
William Aylward is an archaeologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Homer's Iliad is full of stories about the Greek gods, and those stories have inspired food writer Francine Seagan.
Gods and goddesses played a huge part in the everyday lives of the ancient Greeks. The ancients incorporated their gods into every aspect of their lives. Gods and goddesses were involved with practically every fruit, vegetable, grain. They had stories about how and why the gods gave them everything: cheese, honey, figs, bay leaves. And one of my favorite stories is about the origins of a classic Mediterranean food. The story goes like this. The reason Greeks have so many fantastic things is that the gods held a contest to see who could give man the best gift. Whichever god did would have the best city in Greece named after him. Now, each god wanted that honor, so they bestowed the Greeks with fantastic gifts. Poseidon, the sea god, provided Greek islands with easy access to waterways and lots of fresh water on the island. Demeter gave them grains of wheat and techniques for plowing. Athena gave the Greeks olives. The Greeks liked that gift best and so named their favorite city, Athens, after Athena, to thank her for the gift of olives. Many recipes for olive purees are mentioned in antiquity. I recreated one in my book, Philosopher's Kitchen. It's called Herbed Olive Puree. It's just a terrific-tasting puree of green and black olives, onions, garlic, herbs, and spices that were popular then, fennel, cumin, and coriander. It's perfect for dipping with grilled pita and great toast with pasta. Thank you, Athena.
I grew up reading myths about Zeus and Athena and the other Greek gods and goddesses, and they're wonderful stories. But, you know, I have to say they're a bit hard to take seriously in any religious sense, at least for this modern reader. So, do the Greek gods have anything to say to us today? Mary Lefkowitz says plenty. She's a classics professor at Wellesley College, and she talked with Steve Paulson about her book, Greek Gods, Human Lives, What We Can Learn from Myths.
We tend to look down on the gods because the Greeks and Romans, and particularly the Greeks, treated them as being like human beings, anthropomorphic. When they appear on Earth, they look like human beings, and they have conversations with each other. It's like a dinner party or something among human beings. And so the tendency is not to take them very seriously because they're too much like us, and the Judeo-Christian God is not like that. So I think that that's part of our problem. We don't take the Greek gods seriously because they're not like the Judeo-Christian God, and they're not as spiritual. In fact, there's really no room for spirituality here.
Well, you've said that we have a hard time taking the Greek gods seriously. I mean, as a system of religious belief, and part of that, I think, is because they always seem to be quarreling. They almost act like children with their petty jealousies and all of that. And you would think that somehow they'd be above that. They'd be better than us mere mortals.
Well, I guess the assumption that we have is that God is going to be good and God is going to be more noble than we are and will certainly be omniscient. But the Greek gods are not. They do fight with each other and they compete with each other. And that's a wonderful way of explaining why things go wrong in the world. You can be really all right with Athena, but not at all right with Apollo. You can have done something wrong that offends him. And so you're going to suffer. Or Hera can be angry at you. Hera, who's a particularly irate goddess. Look at the case of Aeneas. He was a hero who really hadn't done much wrong. He was just trying to do what he was told by his mother, Venus. And yet Juno, the Roman Hera, persecutes him because he's a Trojan.
So what do you think that people back then would have made of this kind of story? If they have a string of bad luck that somehow the gods were against them, they had offended certain gods?
Yes, I think they'd think that. They'd think that they or an ancestor, someone in their family. It isn't even your own fault. And that seems to me a tremendously realistic explanation of so many of the things that go wrong in the world where you can be completely guiltless yourself, and yet there's a terrible earthquake or something happens that you have no control over. It's a much more pessimistic, less hopeful, and in some ways a great deal more realistic view of the world.
It's fascinating that you would say that. More realistic than religious systems today?
Yes, I think so, because certainly the way I think a lot of us grew up is we thought, well, you know, God is good and God is going to protect us. And if we do right, then we will receive rewards later on. But I think that it's a way, the Greek way, is a way of accounting for the presence of evil in the world, which, of course, in the Christian system was accounted for, in certain versions of it anyway, was accounted for by the presence of the devil, someone that God had to work against.
Now, Judaism started to emerge during this historical period that we're talking about, and then, of course, later Christianity. What did these ancient pagans think of these new monotheistic religions?
Well, they were, I think, rather shocked by them. First of all, the monotheistic religions were so intolerant. They couldn't accept that there were other divinities. A Greek or a Roman would say, well, if you have a divinity, fine, you worship him, just worship ours as well. We will even worship your divinity. We will include him because all gods are welcome. For example, at Pompeii, there's a temple of Isis, the Egyptian goddess, whose worship became very important around the same time that Christianity was developing. But then the religion itself of Christianity struck some pagans as being very strange. You know, why would you worship a human being who died? How could you do that? Because human beings aren't gods.
And I suppose what Jesus does, the fact that he hangs out with poor people, he helps them, he cares about them, that he worked as a carpenter, all of that must have seemed terribly strange to the Romans.
Well, certainly to this one pagan whose works are preserved by a Christian father, whose name was Celsus. Celsus says, how could you worship a carpenter? And he's a person of absolutely no account. The gods are only interested in an elite, in an aristocracy. How can you imagine that he'd take an interest in poor people like these?
Do you think the Greek gods are still relevant today?
Well, yes, I think they are, because polytheism does offer a very cogent explanation of why things don't quite go according to plan, that you can have gods against you as well as gods for you. But I think the other thing that's so interesting about Greek religion is that it starts with the assumption that human beings don't really understand, don't really know. They make some very good attempts. They get stuff right a lot of the time, but they are going to mess up. And particularly when they think they've got it all, you know, completely under control, that's when they're most likely to mess up. These are things that I think, looking back over what I've seen in my life, I find to be really very true take on human experience.
Oh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Mary Lefkowitz is the author of the book Greek Gods, Human Lives, What We Can Learn from Myths. She talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, we'll visit two of Greece's most hallowed places, Athens and Crete. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. George Serenicolo has a bittersweet relationship with the city of Athens. He was born there, but his childhood was marked by violence in his home. He says the fights between his parents made him feel like an outsider, an observer. When George was 12, his family moved to America. But every year since then, he's gone back to Athens for vacations. And he's now written a book called Facing Athens. Serenicolo told Anne Strangechamps that he still feels like an outsider whenever he returns.
I think I have never felt at home any place, but I've always longed for the sense of belonging. So Athens to me in my mind became this place where once I belonged and perhaps I could go back and not be this immigrant anymore.
You write early in the book that during summer vacations when you used to go back to visit Athens, you could blend into the city. I mean, your Greek was perfect. You looked like any other young Greek man. You'd have a feeling of passing for Greek. Is that right?
I could pass for a Greek. I could, you know, sit among people and speak with the same intonation that Athenians use in speaking Greek until they found out that I didn't live among them, that I had immigrated. And then all of a sudden, there would be this pulling back and there'd be this attitude that, well, you're not from here. You don't share what we share. You don't know the things that we thought you knew just a moment ago.
Do you think that would be true anywhere, or do you think there's something very typically Athenian about that, that sense that you are either an insider or an outsider?
I'm not sure about the answer to that question, but I have often thought that perhaps life is so difficult there that this is something that Athenians use, that outsiders just don't understand them. life is too difficult. Anyone who doesn't live there day to day just can't know the problems that they face.
What kind of problems? Because I have to tell you, I was just in Athens on vacation a month ago, and I thought it was an exhilarating, marvelous city. I mean, before I went, people kept saying, oh, Athens, it's too crowded, it's terribly polluted, it's very noisy, it's just too much. And it was those things, but all of that made it exciting. I mean, you could say the same about New York City or any other major city.
I think that's true. I think major cities all experience problems that one sees in Athens. I think the problem is that, to me, life there feels like a great competition, as if people are just vying for space, for jobs, for air, for housing, for a place from which to sit out and look at the sea. And this creates, I think, a tightness to life. It restricts it. And to me, this sense of competition was almost palpable. I could just sense it everywhere, in how cars dart around the city and then vie for a parking spot, how people squat on public land, and how people burn down the remaining trees that are left in the city. All of these things created the sense of competition that just, I think, makes life ugly.
One of the things that Athens is notorious for is terrible traffic, just extremely congested. I've read that the government has actually tried to curb the number of cars by issuing license plates so the cars can only be driven on even or odd days. Has this worked?
Well, Athenians love their cars, and while the city is extremely congested, they have found ways to circumvent such measures. For example, people who cannot drive on alternate days because their license plates end in odd numbers just went out and bought a car and put a license plate with even numbers on it.
So this just encouraged people to buy two cars?
Right. So in one of those, you know, perverted twists to public policy, people probably doubled the number of cars they owned.
Is there a lot of money in Athens?
There is a startling gap between rich and poor in Greece. There are people in Greece with wealth that I have seen nowhere else, not even on, you know, Manhattan's Fifth Avenue. So the answer would be yes, there is a lot of money in Greece. Few people have it.
So where do you find that wealth, and what does it look like? I guess when you say wealth beyond what you've seen on Fifth Avenue, that's sort of mind-boggling.
It is, because the contrasts in Athens are so great. I found an encampment of gypsies, people living in shanties on the ground, within a mile or two of these opulent villas with people with expensive cars who probably had yachts down at the marina or could take a helicopter to go to their favorite island for the weekend. It's that sort of contrast that I think is jarring.
You write a lot about immigrant problems in Athens, how much Athens has been flooded by immigrants from other countries, and also how the Athenians respond to them, how they treat the immigrants. Tell me something about that, because it obviously really struck you on the raw.
I think as an immigrant and as somebody who has lived outside of life in a sense, I was drawn to immigrants. I was drawn to these hundreds of thousands of new people who have entered Greece in the last 10 to 15 years. These are people from the Balkans, especially Albania, but also from the Middle East. There are many Kurds from Iraq and Turkey and Iran, and people from Southeast Asia. There are Pakistanis and Bangladeshis and some Chinese. And their arrival has been a tremendous shock to Greece. In a population of about 10 million people, you now have about a million immigrants. But again, I think we have to understand Greeks' reaction to immigrants in a wider context. You've had the Balkan Wars. You've had a stock market crash. you've had the constant threat of Turkey and nearly going to war with Turkey in 1996. So I think these things have heightened Greek sense that aspects of their lives were outside of their control.
You write that Greeks freely refer to themselves as xenophobic, but that you yourself see them as racist. What kinds of everyday racist remarks, activities did you tend to see?
One of the first things I saw were newspaper ads for housing. I myself needed housing in Athens when I went there to stay and research for this book. And I saw ad after ad saying, non-Greeks need not apply. You see it in talking to people on the street. I talked to many ordinary people who made the word criminal synonymous with being Albanian or Romanian. There's a great sense that immigrants are just, you know, people to be afraid of.
Do you like Athens?
I love Athens. It hurts me. There are many things there that deeply, deeply wound me. This disregard for the poor immigrants, this great sense of competition. But I love the place, perhaps because it's, you know, where I first got a sense of myself and of the world, because of relatives of mine who I love who live there, and because it is a place that struggles with these things. And I understand those struggles intimately, I think, and that creates a love for the place.
George Serenicolo now lives in New York City. He talked with Anne Strainchamps about his book, Facing Athens.
Δεν με νοιάζει με ποιον ακούς απόψε αυτό το τραγούδι. Σου άξιζε μια καλύτερη αγκαλιά. Σου άξιζε μια καλύτερη αγκαλιά. Γράψε μόνο ένα γράμμα που ποτέ δεν θα διαβάσω. Γύρω μας βουίζει πυρκαγιά. Γράψε μόνο μια-δυο λέξεις για ανθρώπους και για τόπους που εμείς ποτέ μαζί δεν θα δούμε, δεν θα δούμε. Δεν θα δούμε.
If there's one place in Greece that has even deeper historical roots than Athens, it's Crete.
For the Greeks of a later time, Crete was the most venerable and ancient place imaginable. It was where everything began.
Barry Unsworth, reading from his book called Crete.
The first herders of sheep were Cretan, the first beekeepers and honeymakers, the first archers and hunters. These last were the mythical Curetes, sons of earth, who attended on the infant Zeus, the father god of the Greeks. The legend has it that he was born in a cave near the present village of Psikro, high in the Dikte Mountains on the southern edge of the Lasithi Plateau in eastern Crete. His mother, Rhea, came here to give birth to him in secret, so as to save him from her husband, Kronos, ruler of heaven, who, having been told that a son of his would supplant him, routinely devoured all his offspring. Rhea presented him with a stone instead, and in his cannibal haste he swallowed it without looking too closely. She then repaired to Crete and had the baby, leaving it in the care of the Curetes, who, in addition to their other achievements, were the inventors of the armed dance, clashing their bronze weapons against their shields to drown out the baby's cries, and so prevent Kronos from discovering the trick that had been played on him, and eating this one too.
Barry Unsworth is one of England's most admired writers. He's famous for his historical novels, some set in ancient Greece. So it's not surprising he has a special fondness for the Greek island of Crete. Unsworth told Steve Paulson that Crete is so old, you can feel the layers of history wherever you go.
The most immediate way that you see it is probably in street names. I mean, in a city like Chania, you see the ancient Greek mythology replicated in the names of the streets. There's a Minos street, Minos the legendary ruler of the Minoans, the king who built the labyrinth to imprison Daedalus and Icarus. There's an Icarus street as well. Icarus, the young man whose father, Daedalus, fashioned wings to escape from the labyrinth and warned his son not to fly too near the sun because the sun would melt the wax. But Icarus, in the joy of flight, forgot the warning and his wings melted and he plunged into the sea near the island of Samos. And so on. You know, it's everywhere present, this sense of a past.
Now, the most famous story of the labyrinth is about Theseus, the hero who killed the dreaded Minotaur, the half-bull, half-man. And then Theseus, of course, found his way back out of the labyrinth by a thread that he'd been given by Ariadne. And I guess the story raises various questions. For one, this figure of the Minotaur, the half-man, half-bull, do we know anything about where he comes from?
There was a bull worship in ancient Crete, although not a lot is known of that either. There's a wonderful piece of sculpture, really, in the National Museum in Heraklion of a bull leaper who could have easily been Theseus, who somersaulted over the bull and landed on his feet at the other side of it. Whether he was a gladiator or a sacrificial victim or a professional athlete of some kind or a priest, we don't really know, but the imagery of the bull and, you know, bull allusions are everywhere. And so there was a cult of some kind. And maybe the story of the Minotaur is somehow associated with that.
What about the labyrinth? First of all, do we know if there really was a labyrinth on Crete?
There's a great deal of talk about the labyrinth. And Cretan sensibility seems to be tied up with the labyrinth. I mean, the original palace of Knossos was huge and had hundreds and hundreds of rooms. And they had a habit of building. They tacked on rooms, one against the other. So in the end, the palace itself was like an extraordinary complex city with rooms leading into rooms, a labyrinth in itself. And so it may be something to do with the architectural style.
And Knossos is the great archaeological site that still exists on Crete, really the cradle of Minoan civilization, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. Knossos was the great city. And it's a marvelous place, really, to visit even now, I mean, even in the ruin. If you can get to it at a time when there aren't too many people around, it's better, because if you get there early morning or sort of sometime when it's a little bit, you know, there's some degree of solitude, it has a tremendous impact.
We've been talking about the story of ancient Crete, but the history has gone on to the present. And one thing that Crete is famous for is how its people have tried to resist various occupiers. There were the Venetians several centuries ago, then the Turks, and more recently the Germans. This is really a country that is built on resistance, a culture.
Yes, that's very true. It's a culture that is built on resistance. It's a resistance that has formed the Cretan character, I think.
And there are stories about horrendous things that happened. For instance, going back to when the Venetians occupied Crete in 1527, wasn't there a horrible massacre?
Oh, the wedding massacre. George Candanoleon, yes. There's a full of mystery, really, that story. He was a local rebel chieftain. At one time, he controlled most of western Crete and became really quite powerful. For reasons that have never been properly ascertained, he went to the house of a Venetian noble called Molino, Francesco Molino, and offered to make some sort of a pact between his people and the Venetians through a wedding between his son Petros and the Molino daughter. And Molino agreed, and the Cretans were invited to a wedding feast, and they came, several hundred of them came, and Molino treated them royally. I think there was 100 oxen or something, and barrels of wine. And then at a certain point, the Cretan contingent became drunk. And at that moment, Molino gave orders for the shots to be fired, which is a signal for a detachment of the Venetian cavalry to come in. And they were all taken and bound and kept there for the night. And then in the dawn, this extremely vindictive Molino personally hanged Candanoleon and Petros, the son. He hanged them with his own hands. And most of the rest of those people were sent off to be galley slaves.
And you write about how there's a kind of folk hero in Crete, and that's the freedom fighter, the guerrilla fighter who resists the occupying forces.
Yes, the palikari, which is still a word used among Greeks for someone very dashing, someone who cuts a fine figure. someone who disregards, you know, sort of petty restrictions and makes his own path, and usually tied up with an ability to use a knife and a musket rather well. And he was the model for this indomitable spirit of revolt, especially in the mountainous parts of central Crete.
Barry Unsworth, the author of the book Crete. He talked with Steve Paulson. Francine Seguin has collected many recipes from ancient Greece in her book, The Philosopher's Kitchen. A few come from Crete.
Crete was famous in antiquity for its food and drink. Ancient Crete was probably best known for two products. The first, wine. Retsina, the famous flavored Greek wine, got its start back then. Back in the days before wine corks, wine-filled clay amphora were sealed with pine resin, which gives it that retsina flavor. The second famous product of ancient Crete was its wonderful breads and baked goods. In fact, Crete was so renowned for its great bakeries that it was the one place that Zeus sent Hermes to get the gods' bread. In ancient Crete, bakers used all sorts of things to flavor the bread. They made bread with capers, fennel, cumin, sage, coriander. They made garlic bread, olive bread, honey rolls. One ancient Greek cookbook author was nicknamed the Cake Doctor, and he wrote about many recipes that were discovered in Crete, including a delicious mix of nuts, honey, and spices that makes a great dessert. I've recreated it as a stovetop candy, mixing sugar, honey, and nuts, peppercorns, cardamom. It's easy to make and lasts for a month or more, well, if you can resist eating it in one sitting. On Crete and the rest of the islands, as a sacrifice to the gods, the ancient Greeks would burn large spice cakes as offerings, and that's where we get our custom of putting flaming birthday candles on a cake.
If you'd like to see the recipe for Candy Nut Chews and the other recipes that Francine Seguin mentioned this hour, you'll find them on our website at www.ttbook.org. While you're there, you can also comment on what you've heard today. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show called Greece, number 88A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Grim news from Africa is easy to find, but there are good things happening there too. The creator of the number one ladies detective agency wants you to know all about them. He calls himself a utopian writer. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll visit the real Botswana with novelist Alexander McCall Smith. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.